You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to Andy Daly, an absolutely brilliant sketch and character comic, someone who, when I found out he was coming to the Edinburgh Festival this year, which of course I am, as I always am, I was absolutely thrilled. I couldn't believe it. It's like having your favourite band turn up on the lineup to a festival you're already booked at. So excited to talk to him. And unusually for this show, this episode is being released almost immediately, as we're all promoing stuff like a fury up here in Edinburgh. So without further ado, here's a tiny bit of ado. I'll tell you what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some of his sketch and character comedy. We're going to talk about the Comedy Bang Bang podcast, the Andy Daly podcast pilot project, which is now, as we learn, sadly on hold. We're going to talk about his show Review with Forrest McNeil, which I really recommend. We're going to talk about his album Nine Sweaters and how he got into doing improv and how he worked and indeed taught for the Upright Citizens Brigade, UCB, in New York and also in LA. So all of that to come. You will hear me throughout this episode try to chisel the smile off my face. So thrilled was I to be talking to someone who's a bit of a hero of mine, Mr. Andy Daly. Oh, so what we're doing here, this show is called The Comedian's Comedian.
Yeah, I've listened to a bunch of them.
Oh, no way!
Yeah, I have.
Oh, I'm stoked to hear it.
If I'm going to do a podcast, I'll listen to at least one episode, and I went down a bit of a rabbit hole. I only listen to the people that... No, that's not true. I was going to say I only listen to the people that I already know, but I delved into some British comics that you've interviewed.
Okay, who did you listen to?
Pippa Evans.
Fantastic.
Is she the one that does the character with the last name Maine?
Yes, Loretta Maine.
Yeah, Loretta Maine. So yeah. I listened to her. And then I listened to a live one you did with another woman who... Joe Brand.
Yes.
I listened to that. And I listened to Jimmy Carr, who I met one time.
Jimmy Carr, who in the States is an alt comic.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, well, I guess he kind of is.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Over here, he's a sort of...
Very mainstream, right?
Yeah, super mainstream.
Yeah.
And in the States, he's this crazy English guy who's got jokes.
Oh, yeah.
Who has jokes?
And they're so fast. Yeah, I met him in Montreal once, and he was very nice. And so. Mm.
So, this is your first time at the Edinburgh Festival.
Yes, it is.
And you said a moment ago your marketing strategy was to go, you know, Andy Daly.
Yeah, right, get on board.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
Because you're, who are you in the States? You're kind of, I mean, you can't be a cult comic in the States. You've reviews gone to like 3-4 series.
Oh, no,
you can't be a cult comic anymore. You're
I am. Yeah. No, I was going to say, like, I've listened to enough episodes of your show to know that I'm a slightly different kind of comic than I think you've interviewed, at least as far as I've heard, in that solo performance with a microphone on a stage for me is secondary or even tertiary to my career. You know, like, I'm a television actor and writer and show creator when it comes to review, and this kind of performance... and I'm not constantly generating new material, and the material that I do is character-based material, which is unusual in the States, I think more so than here, I think. So as far as, like, am I a cult comic? Very much so. As a solo performer on stage, I am, Yeah, I'm an unusual. I'm not a draw. Yeah, it's sort of unusual. It's unusual for me to tour, and then I have a very niche audience when I do. Yeah.
So why are you here?
Why am I here?
Why am I here?
Well, I love Edinburgh. I've always wanted to do the Edinburgh Festival. I've always had a hunch that what I do would go over well in the UK. I've always want, you know, I want UK audiences to know Revue and to see Revue. So this is sort of to help that. And, you know, I don't know, kind of just for fun and to see what it's all about. You know, I'm not doing the whole run.
Ugh.
I know.
Ugh. Pathetic.
I know, right? People
Coward.
Hate that. Well, but it's not my fault. You know what? You know what happened? It was around about April that I realized I had no plans for the summer and that this was finally going to be the year to maybe do the Edinburgh Festival.
Okay.
Now, to me, you start planning something in April for August. That sounds pretty good. That sounds like you're really ahead of the game, but apparently not. That's really late in the game for Edinburgh. So all that was available to me was this 11-night run.
Oh, so it was availability in terms of room, not time.
Right, exactly.
I assumed that Mr. TV Big Shot guy
no.
could only find 2 weeks, or the family man could only convince the family to come.
Well,
for 2 weeks.
It turns out that ends up being actually quite perfect, but the plan was to do the whole run. We're going to do 11 days here in Edinburgh and then do a little tooling around Scotland. And,
amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
So not performative tootling around.
No,
the
right.
Family
tootling
around.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Oh, that seems like a magical way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we should probably begin with the place where you first came to my attention, which is I saw your show last night. I really enjoyed it. I want to talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
And I very much enjoy Revue. But you first came to my attention on a YouTube clip that I think is probably the thing that I have most shared with other people.
Oh, wow.
When I get drunk with comedians and go, oh, my God, have you seen Jerry Ahern?
Uh-huh.
Who is your, I mean, this is how I would describe it to people. I would say he's a stand-up comic character.
Mm-hmm.
Who's a stand-up with no content.
Yeah.
It's the rhythms and the tropes and the shape. As someone who's fascinated with stand-up comedy, I adore that character. So talk to us a little bit about him, and then we'll talk about Nine Sweaters and how all that came about.
Yeah. So this, you know, I was in a comedy partnership in New York in the 90s with a guy named Andy Secunda. We were the two Andys. And we used to crack each other up all the time on and off stage. And we used to do a kind of a bit on the subway where I would just challenge myself to talk for the entire subway ride home from around, you know, Union Square, 14th Street to out to Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Just talk as long as I could without ever saying anything. That was the goal. To just go, you know, I mean, at this point, it's ridiculous because you're sitting here and it's like, this is going on and that's going on. Oh, did I tell you what the other one said? Well, you're not going to believe. Look, to just like throw in as many conversational handles.
Okay, not as a comic.
Just as like a person on the subway telling a story about his day, but never getting to it.
And you would talk, you'd be saying this to Andy or to strangers.
Just to Andy. Okay. Yeah. And his role was usually, he would sit there and go, "You're not saying anything. You're not saying anything." And that was our bit. We would just
try and trip you up.
No, just to like, that was just his response to play along. You know, that was the straight man response in that moment to just be like, "You're not saying anything." Like, and just for the other people on the train to have the experience of this couple of friends where one of them just talks obsessively and doesn't say anything, and the other one is trying to call it to his attention, but it doesn't work.
So this, just to paint the picture, how long is this ride? Is that, I've heard of these places.
It could be about 20-25 minutes.
Okay. And people around you on the train are noticing, actively listening.
Exactly, yeah.
And you're not breaking character. You're not,
never,
you're not laughing.
Right.
At each other, the game exists solely within the two of you.
Yes, and it's a dynamic where the one person is sort of compulsively, obsessively talking without getting to the point, and the other person is trying to snap him out of it. That was the gag. And so years later, I was supposed to do a show at like a midnight at the UCB Theater in LA, and it was a kind of an anything goes late night show. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny to go up and do that for as long as I can? And my thought was that it would anger the audience, you know, that there would be fury. And then the idea of doing him as a stand-up comic just came about because that was a stand-up show. It was a midnight. So it gave me a reason to be there. And so I went up on stage as a stand-up just to try and stay up there for 8 minutes and never say anything. And so, and I found kind of that rhythm of just throwing it. Did you see this? You know, all the stuff, you know, and what else is going on? Just comic tropes and handles and stuff. I didn't get the memo and all that.
Halfway through, you sort of look at the room and you start doing a bit like the comics take on the room. Of going, oh, this looks like someone went, let's try it like this. Yeah. Okay. Like, I mean, it's just, I was just delirious watching it.
Thank you.
So how many times have you done that? And because you know the video that's online.
Yes, I love it.
It's like a shaky cam.
I know.
Recorded from the audience.
I love it. That was at a giant outdoor venue at Jesse Thorne's
Max Fun Con.
And that person does not have a great seat, and they didn't even start it from the beginning. And I love how gorilla it is.
Yeah, it makes it seem more authentic somehow, like we're watching a real comedian, which of course we are, because we're destroying in that, I would imagine, a pretty nerdy audience. I showed that clip to people who have said, well, he doesn't say anything. And you're like, no,
that's the idea.
Any comic I've shown it to has just gone, oh God, yes. Yeah. So is that something do you go back to that character ever? Do you?
I haven't done him in a while. I'm definitely going to do him here. I think I'm going to do him at the...
got to do him on Sunday night at ACMS.
What's
the alternative comedy?
Yes, that's the plan. Yes.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
I'm going to be sending some excited texts to fellow comedy nerds.
Oh,
right, I will get back to a sensible interview and stop gushing now. But I'm thrilled about that.
So the
Nine Sweaters album came about because you were doing regular spots. I have a hazy understanding of it. Why don't you tell me how that actually came
about? Well,
on the strength of that, I downloaded the album and just fell about.
Oh, thank you. Oh, good. Well, that came about because I was on Mad TV, which is a sketch show in the States that ran for a long time. And I was on it for a season and a half, and I just kept pitching sketches that they weren't putting on just constantly. And at the same time, Matt Besser of the Upright Citizen Brigade had moved from New York out to L.A., and he put up a show, like a Thursday night at 11 o'clock show at the Improv Olympic, or the IO West, out in L.A. And the lineup on this show, it was Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn and Matt Besser and myself and Jerry Minor would come and do sets. And nobody was ever in the audience. It was the strangest thing. I don't know why. People would never come. And it was all of us trying out new stuff every week. And so I just went through my notebook of rejected sketches and turned them all into character monologues. And it was so liberating to just be like, I don't need anybody to approve of this. I don't need to get any other actors on board. I'm just boiling it down to one character, putting all these beats in this guy's mouth and making the audience sort of the straight man, sort of the other character. And so I did them at that show, and then Scott Aukerman was doing the Comedy Death Ray live show at Ambar, and he invited me up. And then that just started just in L.A., only in L.A., doing these bits all around town. And then I had the thought to record them on an album, and Scott Aukerman had the suggestion, why don't I, instead of doing an evening of characters to record, why don't I go up once a week at his show at the UCB Theater and just sort of do a residency of I think it was 10 weeks in a row, and record a different bit every night for the album. And that's the way we did it. I'm so glad we did it that way, because I had a week between characters to kind of like hone and work and just focus on one 10-minute piece.
And one of the elements of those particular characters is that something I really kind of delight in is there's the surface character, and then we gradually, it is revealed the sort of the darkness beneath them, or their hidden agenda, or I think the one, I mean, another favorite of mine is the Blarney champion.
Mm-hmm.
So so you've got this Irish character who is telling tall tales and explaining he's won the tall tale competition.
Yeah.
And then throughout, and I sort of don't want to spoil it, I don't want people to listen to it, but we gradually realize the sort of dark, terrible truth behind all of these fun, imaginative lies he said.
Yeah.
It always makes me think of, and I think people who are brilliant at doing that, is South Park. When you go, this is what the episode's about, and then halfway through you go, oh, this is what it's really about.
Right.
It's like the turd sandwich and the giant douche. Oh. And you've got to vote for one of them. They're all as bad as each other. Yes, but you have to vote for one of them. Like, and you go, ah, oh, that's so clever. So talk to me then about that process of... like the fact that they rejected sketches is quite interesting. So what would be the difference between the rejected sketch version of the Blarney character and what ended up on the album?
Ah, well, it would have been written as a scene, and it would have had other characters, and it would have had a straight man sort of calling out the game of the scene all the time, a voice in the room saying, you know, that's terrible. You know, don't tell me that part, you know, or asking what's the real story. It would have just, it works better as a monologue. I think it would have slowed things down to have it function as a scene. It's almost interesting to me to like look at sketches and reconstruct them if you can as monologues, because I think those work better. But yeah, for instance, the Danny Mahoney sketch, the Life of the Party Guy, that was one that was actually written up as a sketch, where you see this horrible character come into a party and interact with the different people. And it's unnecessary. Just put him on stage and make the audience press the audience into that role.
Yes.
Of being the voice of reason.
And it ends up with as a sketch, it becomes very lean because the audience, it's assumed that the audience are saying, but that's terrible.
Right.
Like, you don't need another person.
Yeah, you don't
need
it.
Just stand there and do punchlines.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's obvious.
And not, I don't mean just punchlines, like joke jokes, but like character driven punchline.
Right. Yeah, and the Blarney sketch came from, I was listening to NPR one night, and they were, what did they do? They went live to a bar in Limerick, Ireland, where someone had won a Blarney contest, and they were interviewing
the guy. No, that's not a real thing.
It was a real thing. It was a liar's contest, a Blarney contest, and they interviewed this, and he, in a crowded pub, and he was drunk, and it was a bizarre interview, but it did seem to me like that's a bit of a thing. Like, I have an old Irish relative who described his day. He said, I go down to the pub, I have a few drinks, I tell a few lies. Like, that's a real thing. People do that. They lie. And then to think, like, well, there's a darker side of that, you know. It's
sure.
Fun to explore that.
So anyway, so when you were, I mean, it sounds like this, the Project Nine Sweaters was kind of a side project, or maybe your comedy output, you described as maybe tertiary to your actual career. So does that free you up to just kind of play a little bit more, rather than if you were someone who, I imagine, I mean, I know it's hard to make a living as a comic in the US, I would imagine making a living as a character comic. I mean, is anyone else, as a secondary question, is anyone else doing what you do? Because it seems like I know other character comics, but they seem to fix on one character and then hone that and make that kind of successful.
It's unusual.
Whereas you're more like kind of, here's an idea, I'll do that, smash, well, I'll put that down, I'll do another one.
Right, yeah. It is a little unusual. I mean, there are other, God knows there's plenty of sketch comedy actors in New York and LA who are doing what I do, like take their sketch comedy character and do it as a bit, you know, just in front of the audience all by themselves. Like, that's not that unusual. But yeah, I can't think of anybody who's really trying to kind of make a living at that kind of thing. I think that's pretty unusual. I mean, you know, Larry the Cable Guy is a character, right? So he did that. Dice Man is a character. It's not that it doesn't ever get done.
That's a relief to hear.
Well, is it? Maybe it isn't. It's semi autobiographical. I can't think of what it would be like to try and make a living doing this. I don't know how I would. but what it does mean is that I just try to satisfy myself doing these bits. Yeah.
So when you talk about the audience, and you mentioned earlier on the idea of doing the person who never gets around to saying anything, that it might infuriate the audience.
Yeah.
And that idea seems to appeal to you.
Yes, for sure. Andy Kaufman is, you know, an early hero of mine. I read about him when I was a teenager and tracked down everything that I could find. His Carnegie Hall show, his HBO special, everything that I could possibly find about Andy Kaufman. And then so the first time I ever performed solo on stage, I opened for an a cappella group in my college pub. And I did a bit It was the first bit I ever did where I said to the audience, like, do you like impressions? And of course, Well, here's my impression of Obi-Wan Kenobi. And then I did whatever was Obi-Wan Kenobi's first line in Star Wars, okay, which is something like, you know, the sand people are easily frightened, but they'll be back and in greater numbers. And, you know, so whatever. Okay. Pretty good impression. It's not flawless, but it's okay. And then I did his second line, whatever his second line was from Star Wars. And then the third. And then I just did every line of dialogue of Alec Guinness's from all three movies in order. Exactly. And the idea there, it thrills me to think, like, okay, we sort of enjoyed that first line. That was an okay, whatever, yeah, move on, not so great. And then to hear the second one, okay. And then around the third or fourth, I think people get the premise, oh, this is going to keep going. And it's funny for a little while, and then it ceases to be funny entirely because this is really happening. And then the next wave, if you can get it, of laughs now, that to me is a very magical laugh. After you've alienated the audience with something that seems anti-comedy, then you bring them around to laughing again because of how anti-comedy it is, how confrontational and how off-putting it is. Once that becomes amusing, that's a kind of a magical moment.
And that was something that you did in your... How old were you when you did that first performance?
I was probably 19 or 20, I think.
Because, so. I mean, did you have a sense that there would be that wave of it's not funny and then it's funny again? Because that's quite an advanced or... That's a risky strategy, certainly.
Yes.
And it's quite a sophisticated thing to know of one's audience.
It's what... Well, I had read about Andy Kaufman that he did a bit where he just went up on stage and read The Great Gatsby. And I, at least in my memory of it, he just read that book until he was forcibly removed from the stage. That was the joke. And I think I must have read, or maybe just imagined, that it would have taken... Because I've seen a clip of that. And the premise that he's just going to stand up there and read this book... And we have a lot to get through, and it's a long book, and we'll be here for a long time, gets laughs from the audience. And they think, well, that can't be, like, that's a funny comedy premise, and here we go, and what's he going to do with it? Oh, he's really just going to read. So I think I wanted to play with that and see what would happen.
So this is Andy, and as you can hear, I'm an enormous fanboy, so I'll try and keep this brief and get straight back onto the interview. What do I need to tell you now? A couple of things. Andy's show, if you are here at the Edinburgh Festival, don't miss. He's only here for a couple of weeks, as you'll hear, so don't miss his show at the Gilded Balloon nightly at 8:30. Do get along and see that. Do look up Gerry Ahern. Do yourself a favour and download a copy of Nine Sweaters. I love every track on that album. It's one of the funniest pieces of comedy that I've come across. So please do download that and listen to that. More from Andy in a second. I've got two little things to mention. Little blurbs. Who calls them blurbs? Me. And I must as well remember to tell you that this was recorded at The Place Hotel, a fabulous boutique hotel on York Place in Edinburgh. They're kind enough to occasionally let me record podcast episodes there, and I'm very pleased to give them a little shout out. It's awfully nice. This is the hotel where I interviewed Bill Burr and Carmen Lynch and a few others beside last year. If you're a high roller and you have slightly more budget lying around than I do, then you should definitely check out The Place Hotel in Edinburgh. Now, I'm just going to tell you very quickly, my own show starts tomorrow, so I'm going to throw myself into prep for that. 3:45 p.m. in the Liquid Rooms Annex. It is, of course, free. You must, of course, bring some money with you, just on the off chance you feel like paying. Thank you to everyone that has been posting their Thanks Man t-shirts. Thank you. I forgot to ask you to do this. But a lot of you have chipped in and done it anyway on the Twitter feed at ComComPod, or indeed at the Facebook private group, the Comedian Podcast Facebook group. And so many of you have sent me pictures of yourselves, and I really appreciate it. I'm so glad that you've enjoyed the t-shirts. We will do another. I don't know quite what to do. I don't know if it makes sense time-wise, like sort of efficiency-wise, for there to be just the rolling option to buy them all the time. So what I may do in September is we'll do this design again, and I'll do a post-sale, if you like, a couple of quid more per shirt, just because the people who got in there quick deserve to have a little treat. And we'll do another month where you can put your orders in. I'll print them. I'll have another big day of sending them out, and then that design will be put to bed. So if you'd like one, listen out in September, and I'll try and make everyone aware of those. And if you'd care to donate to the show, you can do so at comedianscomedian.com/donate. You can do that in all sorts of ways. I know you know that you can set up a recurring PayPal payment if you like. You can do that via Moonclerk for a little subscription as well if you're not a PayPal fan. All of that stuff available at comedianscomedian.com/donate. And of course, you can do the occasional one-off payments, or like a lovely lady in a cafe in Edinburgh, not a cafe, sort of a convenience shop in Edinburgh. You can see me standing in the queue behind you wearing my own merch, no less. I have my own. It was laundry day. Laundry day, you're allowed to wear your own merch. And this very lovely lady turned around and saw that I was queuing to buy a little pot of couscous. And she said, "Oh, I'll get that for you. It's the least I can do." Now, I'm enormously pleased to have had £2.99 worth of couscous donated, but it did occur to me shortly afterwards, I probably should have said, no, that's fine. But instead, I was like, yeah, you can buy my couscous, why not? So if you fancy buying me the equivalent of 3, 6, or even 18 pots of couscous, you can do that at /donate. That's everything on that. I've got a tiny postamble for you coming up after the show, but don't miss Andy Daly's show if you are up here at Edinburgh, or if you catch him tootling around the Highlands. I'm sure he'd be pleased for you to nod in an appreciative way whilst maintaining a respectful distance from him and his family. Let's get back to Andy.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So have you, and I think when I've heard certain of the sketches from Nine Sweaters, and I don't really recall which ones, I don't remember that all of them took the roof off. I remember that sometimes there are dissenting voices in the audience.
Oh, what do you mean took the roof off?
Well, no, I mean, some of them were spectacular and everyone's laughing.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them, I feel like I've not heard it for a little while, but I feel like there were some hecklers or some people going, what is going on? People who didn't get it, or was it a sufficiently switched on crowd that everyone got it?
I think it was usually, I think they usually got it, because it was always at the UCB Theater, it was always at the Comedy Death Ray show. The audience generally already knew me once I came on stage. So I don't remember moments like that, except maybe in the Danny Mahoney bit, because he is so...
I think that's the one I'm thinking of. He's such an aggressive dickhead.
Yes.
Who is, and the joke of him is that he's offering a service. I think that's it. Or maybe it's not even, maybe it's a YouTube video of you doing that character elsewhere.
Oh, yes.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And you're getting heckled, but someone walks out and you get jokes about it, and then someone else tries to defend them. Because I don't think you've got round to the joke yet where you're revealing to the audience, like, that you're on the inside of knowing this guy's a terrible person.
Yes. Well, that was a fascinating night, and that's why I put it up on YouTube, because I was asked to headline the Melrose Improv, which I was like, I don't know if my stuff's going to go over it, because that's a mainstream audience, right?
Okay.
You know, they're giving away 2-for-1 tickets at Hollywood and Highland for that show. Like, that's amazing.
I don't know.
Yeah, you all get that reference. That's like the it's become Los Angeles is Times Square in a sense.
Gotcha.
You know, Hollywood and Hylum, and they're handing out tickets. Okay. Anyway, so it's a mainstream audience that I was not sure was going to get or appreciate my character bits. And it didn't go over great. I think I did four shows. And so the last show, Saturday night, the late show, the audience was a little bit drunk. And something weird happened. Like, that character was like the fourth character I had done in the night. But the audience completely related to him as a character. I think it was the drunkenness. And I think it was because another comic had gone on earlier in the night who the audience didn't like. And they heckled that comic. And then somebody left. And so it just... things devolved, and it was perfect for that character to get nasty with this audience that he was starting to lose control of. But what was amusing to me is that the sense that they knew that I am a comic playing a character, but they, as an audience, seemed to forget it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm really surprised to hear that you had been on in character as different
yes.
people. Because if you watch that clip, mm-hmm. it really seems like... that is a completely fresh audience who just haven't, or certain of them haven't twigged. That's
yeah.
staggering.
It's really strange. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And completely leaving the script of what I was prepared to do and just messing around with this audience and insulting some of them and upsetting some of them. It's fascinating. They know it's... but in some ways, it doesn't matter. I remember once doing that character. I think it was also at the Improv. And there was an elderly gentleman sitting up close to the stage, and the character of Danny Mahoney just started making fun of him for being old. And the guy looked upset. And in my mind at the time, I'm thinking to myself, that's funny that he's actually getting his feelings hurt and his feathers ruffled by a character who he's got to know as a character, right? But then later thinking about it, I was like, well, does it matter?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, do you feel kind of licensed to say the unsayable in your characters, because we're part
yeah.
of a shared, more so than just a stand-up. You know, there's this idea that Stuart Lee, you know, the sacred circle of like, we're all in on the joke, I'm a stand-up comedian. You're even more so
yes.
kind of apparent. The joke is even more apparent, and therefore perhaps the sacred circle is more apparent, is more trust, because we know
yeah.
you don't mean it.
I think so. I think, you know, for instance, probably in the show that I'm doing right now, Dalton Wilcox.
I can't believe how pretentious I sounded talking about the Sacred Circle. I'm quoting directly from Stuart Lee. Sorry, do continue.
I'm eating it up. But Dalton Wilcox is probably the character that I do who is most kind of obnoxious to the audience. He's an asshole, not as bad as Danny Mahoney, but he's an asshole.
This is the cowboy poet.
Yes, the cowboy poet and vampire slayer. Character who I do in the show. And I think a lot of the things that he says to the audience, if I were to say them in my own voice, I would feel a need to then in some form say, just kidding. You know what I mean? I would just feel that need to go, no, you know, it's just sort of to say something awful and judgmental and rude, and then to come back and say, no, I don't really feel that way, would feel necessary if I were performing as myself. Not necessary as Dalton Wilcox, because we know he's not real.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you did three characters last night. Mm-hmm. Is this your run here? Is the same three characters every night?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I'm prepared to swap if need be. But
The second character that you did, whose name escapes me,
Don DeMello.
Don DeMello. Yeah. Who is a? If you describe Don to us,
Don DeMello is a theatrical director. He is the director of the Radio City Music Hall Christmas Spectacular, which is a annual institution in New York. It is a Christmas show that involves the Rockettes. I don't know. I actually have no idea how familiar people in the UK are with the Rockettes.
Not at all. I didn't know whether they're a real thing or whether the thing.
Oh,
made up.
Really? Isn't
yeah,
that
yeah,
interesting?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that might explain some of last night's reaction.
Yeah, yeah, I mean,
they need to explain that better.
Culturally speaking, I wasn't. I didn't know whether that was a real thing or whether that you had contrived it for the sake of the character.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
Because the reality is that it's a children's Christmas show. At Radio City Music Hall, which is a classic venue that has this very peculiar holdover from the Ziegfeld Follies days of, it's like can-can dancers. These Rockette dancers come out and they're squeaky clean all-American, but they are of uniform height and big smiles and bare legs doing big high kicks in the middle of this Santa Claus and a live nativity scene children's show. And it's odd.
That, to me, really explains a lot more about the character that I'm not sure as an audience we got last night. Because I wondered how you felt that character went last night. It was really fun and very funny. But there was a sort of a... I wondered if... Do you know what I thought? I don't want to talk out of turn here, but I wondered if the women stopped laughing during that. Because Dalton Wilcox had just destroyed everything you said was funny. I brought three friends with me and I was sat there very happily going, yep, this is in the bag. You know what I mean?
Right.
Brilliant. And then I wondered if, because we're not aware of the Rockettes and that bag, obviously to me now it's like, oh, the joke is he's the seedy guy who's put together this ludicrous... kind of anachronistic, sexy lineup during a kid's Christmas show.
Right.
We don't know what that is. I didn't know that that was going on. So to me, he was just a sort of a seedy, disgusting character.
Right.
And I wondered whether some of the women stopped laughing because you were being very, you know.
Yes.
Like, I mean, all the stuff now that is kind of like, you know, there's a little something for daddy.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Knowing that it's a kid's show,
yeah,
and that's what you're underlining, that throws a whole different light on it.
Isn't that interesting?
That kind of takes the curse off it slightly.
Yes. No, it was interesting to do that last night because that character is so disgusting, so he came about on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast and became a very popular character. The first time I ever did him was Scott's Christmas show, and so I thought, like, let's meet the guy behind the Rockettes, the Christmas show. And people really liked him, and then he was on again with Patton Oswalt, and Scott and Patton asked him great questions, and we really delved into who this disgusting guy is. And he's just become an extremely popular character through the podcast. And I often think, like, he is so disgusting. I'm surprised he's so popular. But you've got to get the right balance of, like, we are gleefully hearing from the bottom of the sewer. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like there's a gleefulness to it. There's something fun about hearing something so disgusting. But it was missing last night, I felt.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
interesting.
The glee of it, and the audience was just like, Jesus, this guy is fucking disgusting.
Yes,
it was a bit disturbing.
Like,
and I have this purely physiological response that, like, I'm doing something, and then I realize that I've broken into a sweat, and that's when I go, oh, it's not going well.
Is that right? Did you get the sweat last night?
I did.
That's interesting.
I got the sweat midway through that character. I was like, oh, and that tells me, like, that tells me it's not going well. It's a very strange response.
That is a fascinating skill to have cultivated. It's like, where are we sweating? You just touched your face there.
Through my shirt.
Through your shirt. Okay, you're like, I'm aware of a wet bag.
Yeah.
I got to get out of here.
I got to get out of this.
we should say as well, just to people who've not seen the show, the format of the show is these three characters. And the third one, if we talk about it, we'll talk about it. I don't want to give everything away because I'm going to put this out soon.
I hope
a few people along. Each character comes out, does a monologue, 5 to 10 minutes, and then just takes questions from the audience.
Right.
And one of the things that was so... such a pleasure to watch in the show last night was how unshowy your improvisation is. Because there's a lot of improv shows, there's a lot of kind of, you know, handshaky, hey, give us a suggestion, guys. You know what I mean? There's that kind of stuff. And necessarily, of course, it's part of the culture of it. Mm-hmm. And actually just, there was something so calmly confident. Like you're obviously on top of your game as an improviser. And so whenever anyone said anything to you, you just got gold out of everything. Do you know what I mean? And there was no, because of the format, you don't need to tell us at any point, hey, I'm going to make a load of stuff up.
Oh,
do you know what I mean? It doesn't have that showy quality. So I suppose what I'm asking is, there will be improvisers listening to this, I'm sure, I hope. How do you get to that level of confidence in your improv? Is it just practice? Are there principles? With that question and answer game, are there principles you're working to? Are there ways that you know you can get out of things?
No, there's no ways that I know I can get out of things. I don't think. I mean, I've done this show a few times, so there are some things that I know have worked in the past that I can come back around to.
Because you might get the same questions.
Yeah, I might get the same questions.
Sure.
I can't think offhand if that happened last night, but there's maybe...
There was a couple... I think someone asked you a question in a very thick Scots accent.
Yeah.
Boring holes in the ground.
Oh, yeah.
Which I guess is because he's seen
right.
that character before, and that leads to a particular joke in that character.
Yes,
which was almost... as an audience member, I was like, oh, don't set him up.
Yeah, yeah, do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, don't challenge him. Yeah, exactly.
Challenge him. Don't go, and now perhaps you'd like to do that joke. You know? No, with all respect to that question.
Yeah. There'll be a mix of things, but that happened there. But I'm trying to think. Well, like, for instance, Don DeMello has spoken in the past about his doomed Peter Pan production, and probably will again. So that I knew I could get to. Definitely being in character allows me to feel more confident because I have a pretty clear sense of who these people are and what they think and how they feel about things. So when I hear a question, I think I know right away how this guy would answer it. And then, yeah, for me, it's just a matter of, let's get to some laugh and move on to the next question. I don't know how else to describe it, but it's staying true to the character and the various games of the character, what this guy is about.
Talk to me about that, mm-hmm. The games of the character. What do you mean by that?
Well, that is, anybody who's ever studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade or read their book will probably already knows where I'm going. But that's the sort of central tenet of that school of improvisation. What you learn when you're first learning to do improv scenes with the Upright Citizens Brigade is that you can start a scene, two people with nothing, just a location or an attitude or anything. And you're working together to find the game of the scene, which means, like, an example that I used to give when I used to teach improv there was like, the Monty Python scene where the guy is returning the dead parrot, right? The game of that scene is that the guy who owns the pet shop will do anything to not take back the parrot. So that's the game of that scene. And if you can imagine that as an improv scene, they might have stumbled upon it with, I'd like to return this parrot. Why? Well, he's dead. And then so now we're laughing, but we know the game of the scene when the next guy goes, no, he isn't.
Yeah, I understand.
We know the game of the scene and we know what we're doing and we're off and running and you just play that out. So the characters have games in a way. So Dalton Wilcox's games, various, are, you know, that he's a belligerent, a Western man who despises city slickers and has a very particular notion of what it means to be a man from the American West. And also that he has these delusions about monsters, you know, and also that he has this sense of what it is to be a cowboy poet that is very particular to him and his weird peccadilloes. You know what I mean? So once I know, like, those are the things that define him, any answer to an audience question can come from those basic aspects of his personality.
Okay, you know what I mean? Okay. Can I just ask, I mean, it's L. Ron Hubbard is the third character.
Yes.
I have to say that because I have to ask whether someone asked you what you had for breakfast. Uh-huh. And you said, those little black peas. And Christ, I was crying. Was that improvised?
Yeah, sure.
Jeez. Yeah. I mean, I love, that makes so much sense. So tell me how that fits into the game of L. Ron Hubbard. Where does that come from? That was such a perfect answer.
Oh, thanks. Well, that, you know, I have read a lot about L. Ron Hubbard. I'm very fascinated with L. Ron Hubbard. I know a lot about him. And so I know that for him, uppers and various kinds of pills were a big deal in his life.
I see.
And yeah, particularly during his weird years on the boat, which is when my L. Ron comes from. He comes straight off the Royal Scotsman. That was a period of time when he was doing a lot of pills. Just to keep going and keep writing and to keep working and keep, because it must have been a very stressful life for him because he's surrounded by these people who are looking at him like, what next?
Yeah.
And he's stuck out at sea. You know,
I don't know so much about his life. I didn't know there was a boat period, but that's a really interesting perspective on him to think once you've overpromised in every result,
yes.
in every way,
yeah.
then people are going to go, what next?
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy, but it literally came to a point where because he was so invested in the notion of past lives that he convinced all of his followers, I think it was, they had three boats, they had a little armada floating around, that he in past lives had buried treasure and that their job was to go find it.
That's so good!
Just like, we got to kill time out here. We're going to go find some of this buried treasure. And time and again, it would be like, oh, somebody got to it. You know, of course they're not finding any.
So is that the only character that you do who is a real person? Like,
I think so. Yes, I think so.
So that's the only research job.
Yes, right, exactly.
So the others, you can decide, okay, the game of Dalton is, you know, monsters and what have you. And so that kind of that reveal about Dalton that actually he's terrified of
Therianthropes.
Therianthropes.
Yeah.
Which sounds real enough that that could be the real word. Like,
oh, yeah, it is.
That's the shapeshifters.
Therianthropes are real. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're a subset.
Yeah, they're a subset of shapeshifters.
So did that originate, like the very beginnings of that character, you had a hat and you went, okay, I'll do a cowboy poet. Like, how much are you walking on with and how much is created in the moment?
Yeah, so that was another one of the characters. So all the characters on my album came about from, you know, either they were failed sketches or after that point they were born as bits to do on stage in front of an audience. The characters that I've been doing over the last few years have all been born on podcasts. Like, I've come on as a podcast guest in character, which means that I come in with quite a bit less and more is found through conversation and improvisation. But the Dalton Wilcox character, I took my children to an equestrian show in Burbank, California, and in between horse acts, a cowboy comic came up, and he did a bit. It was like I don't know if you know Goofus and Gallant. Probably don't.
I don't.
Goofus and Gallant was like, I think it was in High Times magazine, which is a magazine for kids, and it was like a little comic strip of like a guy who does everything right and a guy who does everything wrong. And it was meant to be instructive. Like, Goofus, you know, Gallant brushes his teeth in the morning. Goofus eats a whole sugar donut, whatever. Okay. So he did a bit that was like that, about the guy at the front of the cow herd and the guy at the back of the cow herd. And it was like, it was so specifically cowboy comedy that I was like, I have to do something with that. And so I looked up this guy. His name was Baxter Black, and he's a cowboy poet, and I'd never heard of cowboy poetry before. And he's very much into the wit and witticisms of the West. And so I went on as him. And I wrote some, I knew I had to show up with some cowboy poems if I'm going to do a cowboy poet on a podcast, and wrote them in the initial ones in like 10 minutes of just like, well, so what's funny? What's wrong? What's crazy about his poems? And the first one was about fucking holes in the ground. and then the second one was just about vampires, and just the notion that this guy might believe in and be afraid of vampires just seemed funny to me.
So there, and that's kind of like the kind of Michelangelo, you know, the sculpture is already in the block of marble. Idea. Did you know what I mean? You're like, okay, yeah, of course.
Right.
Of course he's terrified of vampires. Do you know what I mean? So you discover what there is. You discover the games of that character as you go.
Yeah. It came about very quickly. It was very important. The first idea, you know what I mean? Not the second or third idea. What's the first idea?
That's interesting you put it in those terms, because something comics often say on this show is about when you're writing comedy, when you're scripting stand-up or whatever, it's about the third idea.
Right. Yeah.
So that's interesting that as an improviser, you go, nope, first idea. Whatever we have, we go for.
Yeah.
And that sounds a lot easier than racking your brains. I'm always, whenever I speak to improvisers, I'm always jealous, because I'm like, you have no homework ever. You get to go up and just play it.
Well, I know. I once, in the early days in New York of doing improv, we used to sit around. I mean, it seems so crazy now, but we used to sit around this bar called McManus and talk improv and talk comedy. And sometimes there would be like an impressive person in the crowd, and you'd maybe try to get a seat at that table and maybe move a little closer. And I remember one night Adam McKay was there, and I ended up sitting at Adam McKay's table, and he was talking about this.
I'm afraid,
this,
as a Brit, I don't know who Adam McKay is.
You don't know who Adam McKay is? Oh, wow. No, that's amazing. He is Will Ferrell's partner in crime, and so he directed The Big Short, maybe wrote it too.
Gotcha.
And directed the Anchorman movies and Talladega Nights and all that stuff.
I absolutely should have known.
No, that's right.
I couched this in as a Brit. I mean, as a guy with a baby or something, as a guy who doesn't watch enough stuff. Okay.
But at that time, he had revolutionized the Second City show in Chicago in the early 90s, and then went on to be Saturday Night Live head writer for a while. And so he was doing that at this time. And he was talking about the third idea notion, but he was talking about it from an improv point of view, and talking about getting to the point as an improviser where you are instantaneously arriving at the third idea.
Gotcha.
You're not even acknowledging and discarding ideas one and two. You've trained yourself to go straight to three.
Yes.
So I don't know to what extent, and which is obviously, do you know when you're doing it? I don't know.
Sure. But just like your imagination becomes naturally richer, or your first thought isn't, who's that at the door? It's the baker.
Yes.
The first thought is, who's that at the door? It's Werner Herzog.
Yeah. You know
what I mean, it's like
right,
something
exactly,
like your
exactly.
ideas are naturally more specific.
Yes, yes.
So I listened only yesterday to some of the Andy Daly podcast project,
oh,
which I'm very pleased to have only just discovered.
Oh, yeah.
Is that an ongoing?
No.
That
I set out to do a limited series podcast, and so we did 8 episodes, and I'm constantly asked if there will be more.
Oh,
it'd be fun to do more.
It will be fun to do more. Mm. Listening to you as August Lindt.
Oh, yeah.
Discussing with Paulette Tompkins as Werner Herzog.
Yes.
Who was Geiger? Who was playing H.R.
Oh,
Geiger?
Oh, man. That's, why am I? Oh, no. Why am I? About Matt Gourley. Yeah.
Okay.
Matt Gourley is so funny.
Listening to the three of you discuss the moment in Grizzly Man where Herzog is listening to, I mean, I don't want to spoil the movie, but
there's
an unpleasant thing that Werner is listening to.
Yeah.
And just the amount of, I mean, that is just an exemplary piece of improvised comedy.
I love
everyone is contributing so beautifully.
Yeah, yeah. And that's Matt Besser as Pope Benedict as well.
Yes, of course,
in that
yes.
conversation.
And everyone is having third thought type thoughts, whereby, you know, what is that? What were his last words that he was... Why didn't he want to play us the last words that he was screaming?
Right.
Did he use the N-word? You know, and it's just, well, of course, why would you not in that situation? And it just seems to me to be... Four people are just at the height of their powers as improvising. I mean, what an incredible thing to listen to. I listened to it, then I immediately got everyone else in my house. And listen to this now.
Oh, yeah.
So, again, I was turned down the gushing. Got to turn that into a question. Got to find some way to get to extract some useful information from that. The idea of gradually getting to the third idea and gradually improving, like... What is there anything you could say to the Andy Daly of 20 years ago, still learning to improvise? What shortcuts, and I mean in a very personal, a very specific way, what things could you 20 years ago have improved on that it took you this time to learn? Good question, right?
It is a good question. Because in some ways I feel like, I don't know, I may have been more on my game 20 years ago in some ways, except that... what I was probably not calm enough. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I think I used to think that it was all about that having fast, good, funny thoughts was an energy game. You know, and that it required just an enormous amount of every reserve of adrenaline that your body could pump out. It's not at all. You know, there can be a quiet and a calm. And I would see other improvisers, more seasoned improvisers, who seem to be just confidently taking their time and knowing it was going to come and just thinking like, well, that's, I don't know how you do that. But I feel like over time, I'm more trying for that. You know,
I'm you're being very modest now about your ability. Is that you look like then you were trying not to say, and I've really nailed that now?
Because I truly haven't. I mean, like, so I do occasionally an improv show with people that I've been improvising with since the mid 90s. We sometimes in LA get together and do an improv show, and it teeters on the brink of too unenergetic. You know what I mean?
A bunch of very experienced people calmly not improvising much.
Yeah. Maybe we're a little too confident that we'll get there eventually. So what I mean is that I'm more in that world of like, we're going to sit down and we're going to have a conversation and we're going to get to something funny, as opposed to I'm going to bounce off all of the walls. But it's, you know, it's not a 100% success rate. Sometimes it's just a sleepy show.
So let's talk a little bit about review.
Yeah.
of which the premise... Now, I discovered whilst Wikipedia researching you that the premise of Review is based on an Australian show, based on an existing show. So tell us about the premise and tell us about the difference between those two shows.
Yeah, so it came to me by way of DVDs on my porch one day that my agent had sent me because I guess Comedy Central had Comedy Central in the States... had learned of this Australian series that they thought I would be good to adapt and star in. And it is a show about a guy who's, he's sort of a sociologist in a way, but also a reality television star. He's a very serious-minded sort of public intellectual who is reviewing life experiences. He's a critic. And so the audience will ask him anything. What's it like to get addicted to drugs? What's it like to have road rage or whatever? And so, he will just fully immerse himself in the experience of that from the point of view of a sort of a scientific observer, almost like a visitor from another planet, someone who has never had any of these experiences. And what was funny to me watching the Australian version, it could just be, and it often is in their version, just sort of one-off segments, you know, but in their second episode, he reviews what's it like to divorce your wife. And there's a moment in the custody hearing where the opposing side says, well, just look at what this man has done in the last 30 days. He has trained with Al-Qaeda. He has become addicted to ICE. He's gone whale hunting in protected waters. And you know, as an audience member, as you're watching this, these are things he's reviewed as a life critic. And it is preventing him from having shared custody of his son. So that, to me, was really the heart of the show. And when we were going to adapt it for an American audience, I, along with Jeffrey Blitz, who's my co-showrunner on it, said, that's what we really want to do. I'm not interested in doing the one-off segments so much. I want to really explore the extent to which a guy who fully immerses in experiences brings these extreme experiences that people want to know about into his life, what the impact is on his existing life, and how it destroys his life to do that.
By the beginning of season three, the state that that Forrest is in and that his producer is in, and seeing Forrest go back to his former family home in order to borrow a dog, like to go and put a dog to sleep. Like the idea that the first dog he would think of is, it's gonna have to be my dog. Right. You know? It's a wonderful. It has a certain kind of Simpsons quality, and I mean that in the very best way. The sort of the mundanity of daily life, and the fact that he is living a very real life,
right?
Whilst kind of, you know, he's falling apart. And we should say as well that the show, at the end of each section, he reviews the experience out of five. And I think that's, to me, that's such a glorious joke.
Yeah.
Something could be summed up out of five.
And so obviously that was part of the Australian series, and it was just something that we knew we had to do. And in the writer's room, we didn't even think much about it. Like, we never really, really considered too closely whether he was going to give it anywhere between one and five stars. And that just seemed like, whatever, it just has to happen. It's a convention of the show. But the first time that I played an episode of that show live in front of an audience, I brought it to the UCB Theater and showed it to, you know, an audience of 100 people. The fact that he goes through all of this and then comes back to the studio and says, two stars, got a huge laugh, an unexpected laugh for me. I was like, yeah, that's funny.
Yes.
It is funny that he thinks he can reduce a very complex life experience that impacted himself and his family and the world around him in major ways down to somewhere between one and five stars is absurd and funny.
So where is the show now? What is it? Is it?
It's over.
It's over.
It's all done.
Okay.
We did our first season, was very critically acclaimed and quite low rated and fairly expensive to make by the standards of
the big three.
But because it was so critically acclaimed, Comedy Central gave us another season, which was very nice of them. And that season was not more expensive, but it was more critically acclaimed and less viewed, I believe. So that put them in a tough spot, but they gave us a chance to wrap it up with a third seasonette, I would call it.
Okay.
So we did that, and we ran with it, and they gave us zero notes, no feedback. They just said, here's a pile of money, wrap it up. And I love what we were able to do with that.
There's a pile of money and no notes.
Yeah.
What's the next project, and will you be in that situation again of here's a pile of money and no feedback?
I doubt it.
I mean, that sounds like that's the mecca of, you know.
Yeah, well, that was amazing. No, I don't know. I have three different shows that I'm trying to get kind of off the ground right now.
Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, one of them is an animated show all about Dalton Wilcox, which I would love to do. I think, you know, I've written it. I have no idea if people will be interested, but I'm out
there. Why is it animated?
Oh, that's a good question. Why is it animated? Mostly because I feel like I actually don't look like the iconic cowboy poet that I want Dalton Wilcox to look like.
He looks more like a kind of... I've lost the name of the actor.
Sam Elliott is the iconic cowboy.
Of course it's Sam Elliott,
And I think Dalton Wilcox wants to look a little more like that.
But it's important that you play him. Sam Elliott.
I don't think I could. I mean, maybe. That's an interesting concept. But no, I'd want to play him. And I think it just might be more fun. I've done some animated shows that work, like the cast for each individual scene is in the room together recording at the same time, and then once you've got the script you improvise and you have a lot of fun with it, and that feels to me like the right way to do a show like this.
Okay.
You know, it's sort of like the way we do the podcast pilot project.
Yes.
I'd want to recapture that for an animated show.
Do you think that now the world of podcasting, kind of post-Comedy Bang Bang and the pilot project, which I should say I kind of worked out recently, the premise of that is it's a pilot for a podcast.
Each episode is a pilot.
Yeah. Which is, you know, given how easy it is to podcast, there's a lot of joke. But is there kind of interest for making things that are based on podcasts? Or do producers go... Oh, that's a podcast. That is its own platform.
I think there ought to be interest in it. But the fascinating thing to me about podcasts, I would never have guessed 10 years ago that there would be this much audience for podcasts. You know, that there would be so many people who have enough time in their week to listen to this much content. I don't know what those people were doing previously on their commutes or at their jobs that don't require all their attention.
I listen to a lot of podcasts and I do. What have I lost? What have I sacrificed to listen to this many podcasts?
I'll bet
music.
Not much. Yeah, music, I guess. maybe news.
Exactly. Audiobooks? There must be a cost somewhere.
But there's so much out there in podcasting that I think it's very fractured. The audience must be very fractured. So I think for instance, Comedy Bang Bang had a television show. And I think they knew going in, like, we're going to make a very inexpensive television show for a very niche audience, you know. I feel like that was a great television show because it took all of the wonderful elements of the podcast and put them on screen in a very colorful and fun and crazy way. So I feel like that should absolutely happen more and more, but probably in that same spirit of like, there's a niche that likes this. Let's program to that niche, and it's going to have to be cheap. That's all.
So is there, and you may have heard me ask, if you've heard this show before, you might have heard me ask a version of this question to other people. Mm-hmm. Are there any... Like, are there any elements of your creative life that are problematic? Because I often find with stand-up comedians, I can go, "Are you happy?" And they'll say, "No, I'm not happy." Because I sit in a room trying to come up with ideas, or I'm on the road and I'm trying to sort of see the world and, you know, get to grips with it in a certain way. I think when I talk to improvisers, I feel like I say, "Are you happy?" And they go, "Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just playing this great game all the time."
Yeah.
Are there any harder aspects? Are there any psychologically more painful aspects of any part of the process for you?
Oh, God. I mean, of course, it's such a complicated business. But I've been saying for the longest time, like since the mid-90s, I have been saying, creatively, I am fulfilled. Like, because I can get on stage and do an improvised show, and it's always going to be fun, and sometimes it's going to be great. And I can also get on stage, I can write a character bit just entirely for myself, and there will always be a place to get up on stage and do it. So from a creative point of view, just knowing that there's an outlet and a skill set that match up well and that I enjoy doing it, like, I don't need more than that, really. I'm not a person who has a creative drive to be involved in making films, which is hard, or even making television. I don't have a creative need to do that. I have a monetary need to do that, you know what I mean? But yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, like, there's professional jealousy, and there's competitiveness, and there's a feeling of like, oh, I haven't been out there enough, and people are forgetting me, and how am I perceived? Maybe I'm not perceived the way I want to be perceived. There's all those kinds of large, looming, annoying questions. But from a creative fulfillment point of view, I think I've been creatively fulfilled ever since I found the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York, and that stage, which is so accepting of any kind of crazy crap. And it, now there's one in LA, and there's multiple spaces in LA that just you can walk into and do something that is completely just to satisfy yourself and an audience. You will find an appreciative audience. Like, that's all I really need, you know?
How do you want to be perceived?
How do I want to be perceived? That's a tough one. Because I feel like there's... I guess I want to be perceived as a... So this is that point that you're talking about, where like
yeah,
somebody
sure.
goes, now I'm sounding pretentious. But yeah, as a comedy artist, as somebody like Andy Kaufman, who you look at and you say, oh, he's doing something new and different and unique that nobody else would be able to do. And it is an expression of himself for himself, and we get to join along. You know, we get to jump along for the ride. I think that's how I'd like to be perceived, as fearless.
And what would it fulfill in you to be perceived like that? Why?
I don't know. I would just feel... feel good about myself. That's all right.
Well, why is that? Why would you feel good about yourself if people think you are fearless?
Why not? Because the alternative is to be somebody who's out there trying to be commercial and trying to pander, right? I mean, that feels like the other end of the coin, the other side of that coin. It's just like somebody who's like, just wants to be commercially successful. I would love an audience to feel like, well, this guy clearly has no interest in that.
This may not be true of improvisers. Mm. I think it's probably true of a lot of straight stand-ups. Is there, and I wouldn't dream of asking you to name this person, but is there perhaps a person who you fear that you're a bit like, or you fear that you're perceived to be like, that you wouldn't want to be perceived to be like?
Oh, that's funny. Is there a particular person? Not really, but there is a vision of myself that I see. Because it's always a balancing act between a desire to please the audience and a desire to please yourself, and the question of how far you will go to feel like you're pleasing the audience, and the fear that you'll lose what's kind of hot and interesting for yourself. And so I can't particularly think of somebody else who I think has gone too far in that direction. God knows there's plenty, but you only know it for yourself, right? You only know for yourself if I've gone too far to make an audience happy, and I've lost what I myself came here to do.
Because it strikes me that there are, if Andy Kaufman is so important to you, there are maybe, like, would he have done some of the commercially successful things that you've done?
Right, probably not. I mean, he was in a movie called Heart Beeps.
Was he? I'm not aware of that.
But yeah, that was bad. But and also, I think for him, I think Taxi was a weird one for him. And I think he probably felt I think he probably was very conflicted about Taxi, mm-hmm. even though he was doing his own character that he created on that show. I think it tortured him a little bit to be doing something that successful. And then you saw his response to it, which was he turned himself into a pariah. You know, like he took the fame of that and turned it dark, you know. So I think he was a soul in conflict.
And you don't strike me as a soul in conflict.
No, partly because I have a family, you know what I mean? And so for me, like, I do want to do commercially. I mean, I want to do commercially successful things. I want to make a living in this business. But for my own creative life, when it's something that it's clear that, like, I am making this, that to me wants to feel like it's coming from a place of, like, fearless self-satisfaction as an artist, you know. So I want to be doing both things.
As someone who is embarking myself, I'm now a year and a half into that tightrope act of I now have mouths to feed.
Yeah.
And I want to be creatively, I want to be true to myself artistically. And I'm also like, I was talking to a brilliant actor. I highly recommend you see Colin Hoult at this festival. He's an excellent improviser, does a character called Anna Mann, and his show this year is how we stop the fascists. Mm. But she's like a sort of aging, the character is a sort of aging theatrical performer with a string of meaningless kind of credits to her name. Brilliant. I think you'd really enjoy it. Mm. But I was saying to him recently, you know, how are you coping with the demands of being a dad in comedy? He's got a young family as well. And he was saying, I've absolutely gone insane worrying about how to make enough money.
Yeah.
Is that the fact that you're nodding is like, yeah, you do. You go insane. Is there a solution to that? Yeah. Is there some,
No.
For anyone listening to this who is being, and I remember when, before I had a family, before I had my own child, I remember seeing other comics who had started or were starting, like, I've got a young kid, but I really want to be a comedian. I'm starting. And I was like, you're insane. Yeah. I'm so impressed.
Right.
I'm scared.
Yeah. I mean, the only saving grace for me has been that my wife is very calm and confident, and so we constantly have conversations where her role is to say, yes, you always say that and it always turns out fine.
my own wife will listen to this at one point and will be laughing away at that, the similarities in that.
I was interviewed once by Greg Fitzsimmons. It's a very funny podcast, and he was just like, you've got kids, hon, you're an actor, and so that's it, you lay your head down on the pillow every night and go, I gotta, as an actor in show business, feed these mouths and make this work. It's like, yeah. But his point of view was like, I mean, I have relationships at clubs around the country. I can tour and I can get paid. But it was kind of like, well, I, as an actor, have relationships in town that I, you know, people know of me. So I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that. But it's terrifying. It's complicated to take that on. Actual financial responsibilities in this crazy business where, you have to constantly earn your seat at the table all the time, you know?
Do your childhood friends or college friends consider you a success? Or do you think you are considered a success in their terms?
I suspect probably so, because it's an odd thing. Like I pop up on television a lot in the States, and you know, and I think people have an inflated sense of what you get paid when you're on the television screen.
Good answer.
So yeah.
And do you have to audition for roles anymore, or do people go, Andy Daly will be good at this?
So it's a mix of things. Yeah. Sometimes, I'm more likely to be offered things these days, but yeah, I recently had an audition for a small role in a Clint Eastwood movie. Ooh. I didn't get it, but that was a recent audition. Yeah.
Okay.
So something like that comes along.
And do you still get nervous before those kind of auditions? Or do you feel like I'm here doing what I do? Like you can't get it. I can't get it wrong because it's me doing it. So I'll just give them what I do.
It depends. If it does feel like something where I know what to do with this, then I feel fine. But then there are other times I go into auditions going, I got a bad feeling about this one.
And what is it? What sort of circumstances create that bad feeling?
I don't know what to do with the character. I don't know. It doesn't feel right. You know, but I
but you want the money and the
but also not only that, but Eastbound and Down was probably the show that that did the most for me early on. And when I got the script to audition for that, I said, well, they're not going to hire me. Like I knew what I would do with the audition, but I really did not see myself getting hired for it.
Why
so that's
not?
A little
Why
different
not?
Because the character was a triathlete and he was somebody who the main character was going to look at and feel jealous of. And so I had this image in my mind of like somebody who was really fit and just like super classically handsome, who was just going to, you know, that Kenny Powers was going to walk in and look at him like this Adonis and just go, oh, of course he took my love away from me. I'll never get her from that guy. So I don't know why they hired me, but I... and when I said to them, I was like, because there's a scene where I had to appear in a Speedo at the beginning of a triathlon, and I was nervous about that for a number of reasons. But I said to the guys, Danny McBride and Jody Hill, I was like, do you guys know, like, you know, like, I'm not really in shape or anything like that. I'm not like, I don't look like a triathlete. And they were like, yeah, I think your character is a triathlete in his own mind. Like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't pick that up from the script.
Okay.
You know, that in their mind, he talks a good game, but he's a failed athlete.
Yes. And presumably for you, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. That opens the door then. That's the game of the character.
Yes, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. That helped a lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To wrap up, before we wrap up, just to come back to this, if I dare delve into the conversation you have with your wife, the kind of,
yeah,
like, we've had this conversation before,
uh-huh,
that strikes me as that might be an interesting way to find out what sorts of things make your wife roll her eyes when she's like, oh, this again.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm constantly just like, oh, it's another pilot season. I don't know if you know what pilot season is.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to get anything. I'm not going to go. Then what are we going to do? And then, because I'm always looking ahead. I have this terrible habit of like, well, we recently put the dog down. But when I would take the dog for walks. And that would be my time to like look forward and ruminate on like, well, so if by this point I don't sell that idea, then I'm not going to have this and I will have wasted all that time. And then those auditions will come along and I won't be available to do that. And then that, and that, and it's just sort of like I'm making predictions. And I will even sometimes I will sit down and I will type out my predictions, which are always dire predictions, which when I go back and read them later are always wrong.
That's like a reverse affirmation.
It's a reverse affirmation.
A reverse version of a kind of cosmic ordering or whatever it's called. You know, you write down your list of goals.
Yes.
And then you come back to them a few years later and you realize, I achieved all my goals. You're doing
I do the exact opposite.
Negative
I do the exact opposite. I constantly sit down and go, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to do this and then that's not going to happen and then that's not going to happen. And then this, I predict out a dark scenario all the time. And then, and when I share it with my wife, she knows that my record of predicting things is terrible and that it's always pessimistic.
That is almost a sitcom pitch in itself. The reverse affirmation
guy. Right. The secret? Wait, remember that thing? The secret?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the secret.
The dark secret.
Yes. And it works for me. I put out into the world the darkest possible vision of what's going to happen and it doesn't come true.
Last question. What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
Oh, crap. Did you ask this in every episode?
Once or twice.
Oh, man. What would I want engraved on my comedy gravestone? Well, now that we're in this sort of realm, I would want to say, he put his kids through college. That would be nice.
So that was Andy Daly. Thank you so much to Andy for coming on the show. Thanks to you for listening and sharing the show with your friends and giving me lovely favourable reviews on iTunes, especially if you're not in the UK. And thanks also to The Place Hotel on York Place in Edinburgh. Have a little look at their website. It's very, very nice. Very, very posh isn't the word. Classy. You can tell how non-posh and non-classy I am because I use words like that. That's everything. I'm wheezing. Don't worry about my health. I think I've probably... I can't be getting a chest infection this early in the goddamn festival. It's probably allergies. I think we've got quite a dusty room here. But as the Boutros and the missus are away in Glasgow for a couple of days to let me get embedded in the festival and let me get the show up on its legs, I am wheezing. I don't know why I mentioned them. I'm falling apart. I'm so tired. He hasn't been sleeping so well. And now I'm gonna go to bed. This being the night before my show, I'm going to go to bed and get a sweet 10-hour sleep via the use of some melatonin. So hooray for me. I'm going to chip off now and do that. But first, I'll have a little post-amble at you. Jesus, this was a rambler. Shall I redo it? No, I'm too tired, and I've got to work out the intro music for the show tomorrow. So with this, we will all have to settle. Oh, I meant to say, we talked about it on the podcast, but if you haven't, if you've seen Grizzly Man, the Werner Herzog film, do yourself a favour and search for Andy Daly, Werner Herzog, Grizzly Man on YouTube, and you will cry laughing at the conversation he has with Paul F. Tompkins and some other very funny people as well. Speak to you soon. So all I wanted to say, I can't believe I took the couscous. You terrible couscous taker. All I wanted to say was I did a very fun gig here today in Edinburgh and it taught me something about comedy. This was a joy. I suppose I'm being slightly tongue-in-cheek about this, but I also slightly mean it. I did a show. God, that was an awful wheeze. I could ask Daryl to cut the wheezes out, but no, we're going to have to live with me and my wheezing. I've got an inhaler somewhere, and I've got some antihistamine. I'm sure I'll be fine. You don't need... This isn't Jesus Christ. I'm not 90. Sorry. Right. Nor am I disparaging 90-year-olds who would quite justifiably talk about wheezing. I did a show. I did a 10-minute spot at a gig, which I believe is called Classic Joke Club, run by Mr. Ben van der Velde. It's the second year of this, and I'm so pleased that Ben has done this. It's just comedians telling their favourite old jokes, because I was going to do that, and now I don't have to bother. I can just turn up and play at his gig. I did 10 minutes of some of my favourites, the beekeeper's joke, the little boy in the welding mask, the black cow and the white cow. All of these jokes you will probably have heard if you've popped into Redacted at any time. But, you know, not all of you have. But I did those jokes and I did a really fun 10 minutes of pub jokes. That's what the premise is of the show. And here's what happened. Some of them went well. Some of them didn't. I think I performed them all well. I mean, if anything, I probably didn't contextualise them well because I love an anti-joke and I probably did sort of 4 or 5 anti-jokes one after another. But... the fact remains, not everyone liked these perfect jokes. And because I've never done anyone else's jokes before, it completely removed the... in a proper, you know, proper paying performative environment, it completely removed my concern that the material might be to blame when a punchline didn't land. You know, I've always do my own stuff, and if you tell a joke and, you know, the audience are a bit limp... the reaction's a bit limp, then you think, oh God, well maybe, even if you've done that joke brilliantly 100 times, you think, oh God, maybe that joke does have flaws, maybe it is weak, maybe I'm terrible. It's easy to sort of fall down that rabbit hole. But here was I doing jokes that I believe in my heart of hearts to be as close to perfect as a joke can be. And some of them didn't really land. The audience were a bit like, oh, yeah, welding mask joke. I was like, no, you're wrong. It was very fun telling them they were wrong. So what I learned, a pathetic 12 years into my career, is that sometimes the audience are wrong. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Speak to you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.